Tessa Sauter. She's my special guest in the studio tonight, a protege of jazz vocal legend Mark Murphy, who called her an extraordinary talent. She's performed all over the world, including four sold-out tours of Philharmonic Halls of Russia. She's performed at San Francisco Jazz, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Blue Note in New York City, The Jazz Standard, Joe's Pub, Pizza Express in London, the London and Edinburgh Jazz Festivals, and the Kennedy Centre. In fact, the New York Jazz Record put it succinctly, the words seem to come from her soul. Tessa Sauter, welcome to Now's the Time. Tessa, you keep a fairly busy schedule. I counted approximately 39 or 40 shows on your website during 2017 last night.
Oh, really? I don't know.
Would you like to be working more than that, or is that about right?
No, much more than that.
Much more than that?
Yeah. It's the only job probably on earth that you want to do more.
Yes. Yeah.
You want to do overtime. Yes, please.
In past lives, you were a cleaner, you were an editor, a writer.
Yes.
Freelance journalist. Tell us the story how you gravitated towards singing and then eventually jazz.
Well, I sang, you know, just from when I was a little, very small child. My mum used to sing with me. It was our thing that we did together. So there was that. Then when I was about 12, I took up the guitar and I played the guitar and accompanied myself singing folk songs. I was just crazy about Fairport Convention and Pentangle, Sandy Denny and Jackie McPhee and those people. And I guess now I look back and listen to it, I can really hear the influence of that on my music. But I didn't listen to it for many, many years. And I listened to it again recently. I was like, oh, my God, I'm such a copycat, you know, because it's really jazz folk kind of.
Yeah.
But and then I actually got married when I was super young. I was 16 and I had a baby. And basically I had to just really kind of put all my little childhood dreams of singing kind of on the back burner. And I never really thought about becoming a singer. I just sang all the time. I just sang at home. I sang for my friends and my family and everything. But it wasn't until I went to San Francisco and I was living there for a couple of years. I was establishing myself as a freelance writer. And I went to a local karaoke bar and sat in. I sang Cry Me a River. And somebody in the audience heard me and befriended me. And we used to go out every Sunday to hear music. And he used to push me to sit in. And I didn't really want to. I really didn't want to. But then we got into a relationship, and we'd have arguments. We'd go to a place, and he'd say, "You should ask him to sit in." You know, I'd be like, "No, no, no!" And then all the way home, we'd have this huge argument: "Why didn't you sit in? You should have the nerve!" And all this kind of. So, and then it's a bit long story, but anyway, he actually fell out of love with me, which is very tragic, and for me at the time. Although I'm super happy now, but at the time I was very unhappy, and I thought, well, I'll pursue this singing thing. Maybe it'll make him love me again. So I pursued it a bit more by going on my own to open mics. And people would say, oh, where can I hear you sing? And I'd be like, well, actually, nowhere. But then it really sort of almost happened by accident. I sort of would fall into things. And the next thing I know, I had a weekly gig. And that during that period, I built up my repertoire. And then I sort of, next thing I know, I was kind of into it, you know, and gradually I made that switch from journalism, because I did become a journalist, and more into singing. Now I very rarely do journalism, but I do occasionally do the odd bit.
So it sounds like you're sort of the living epitome of that Charlie Parker quote. What did he say? Something like, if you don't live it, it won't come out of your horn.
That's right, yeah.
And so you've really lived your life.
I certainly have lived my life. I think it's the thing about jazz is that there isn't really an age. You don't have to be like a pop star. You don't have to be 15. Although it kind of helps, I think, if you're young in some ways. I don't think that older people are necessarily better. I think young people are also, you know, have got just as much to say, because it's all about passion and you're sort of channeling. It's almost not what you've been through.
That's right.
Although what you've been through does colour what comes out of your horn. but you don't really necessarily have to have been through it, because it's almost as if you're channeling it from somewhere other than yourself.
Yeah, the energy levels of the young musicians and young artists is sometimes quite extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, and if you think about people who were, I mean, I think, the composer of Lush Life, whose name has sort of rushed out of my mind.
Billy Strayhorn.
Thank you. Billy Strayhorn was 19, I think, when he wrote Lush Life. Mm. That's so mature and incredible.
Well, we heard Mark Murphy earlier in the program. What was it like to have him as a mentor and Sheila Jordan as a mentor?
No, it was very ridiculous. Well, Mark Murphy, wow, he was such a one-off. I mean, he's such an unusual person. And as a musician, I mean, as a person, he was sort of a little, almost not that all there, you know. He was very strange and sort of eccentric, completely eccentric. But as a musician, he was so focused. And I used to go to all his workshops because he had me as his mentee, if you like. But in exchange for that, I ran his workshops once a month. And everything he said to people, whenever, you know, somebody would sing, and everything he said was exactly the note that you think, oh, wow, you're absolutely right. You hadn't really noticed it, but that was his main thing. He was like a piece of music, you know, with the personality attached. Mm. So that was an extraordinary experience, because he was very loving, very giving. He used to come to all my gigs and bring me flowers, and he was a really special person. And I used to think of him as like the sun, and Sheila Jordan was like the moon, because Sheila Jordan is very different, very gentle, very whole. She's not eccentric. She's solid and down to earth. Mark was all like all over the place, and so they're very, very different, but both extremely giving, and really I learned so much, and both very generous in the music. You can't be a teacher or a mentor unless you are generous. It's just not possible. So they had that giving, which they did with their music as well, I think. Yeah. Or they do with their music. Well, Mark did, and she does still at 89.
Yes, incredible, isn't it?
She is amazing. She's really amazing.
You've released, four or five albums to date?
Four, but four. I've got another one coming up, yeah.
I noticed some Japanese pressing on your website as well. Is the Japanese market especially lucrative for you?
No, it's interesting, because somebody was telling me the other day they think the bottom has fallen out of the Japanese market. Maybe it has, I don't know, because the last album I did was actually Beyond the Blue. I originally recorded that for them, I think in 2011 or something. So that was the last time I did a Japanese album. But I'm about to go on tour. Well, not about to, but in October I'll be there on tour. So we'll see how CD sales go. I mean, the person who's taking me with him, it's a guitar player, he says that he always really sells a lot of CDs when he's in Japan. And I have noticed that CD sales have definitely dropped off, certainly in the US. You know, I'd do a gig and maybe sell 60 CDs. Mm. And where I might now, at that same festival that I did that one night, sell 20. So it's definitely harder. And people will come up to you and they say, oh, I listened to you on Spotify. And you say, oh, thank you for that. 0.01%. Yeah. No, I don't mind. No, I'm just glad to be listened to. But I do know people who really get jumpy uppy downy about Spotify. They don't like it. So that's a shame. But it's only a shame because, Spotify are making a lot of money. That's right. Thing. That's they need exactly to be sharing right. That. But other than that, it's great to be listened to, I think. That's what I like.
Yes, it's almost like an online marketing tool more than anything else.
It is, I think.
But I think you're right. You've got to be able to do the live performances so you can actually shift your CDs.
Yeah. That's so where you. That's mostly, I think, where you sell. But people then do also download you on Apple and Amazon and those various places that they can. So I don't know. Some people, and also a lot of people, don't even have CD players anymore. Mm. I mean, so many people I know, especially in London, where nearly all my friends are, you know, all my people I knew when I was a journalist, none of them have record players. You're like, what? Yeah. Or CD players? Hello, ragga players.
You've performed on stages all over the world, Tessa. You've worked with Alec Dankworth, Charlotte Moffat, Joe Locke, Alan Broadbent, Steve Coon, to name just a few. But can you describe one or two highlights over that career that sort of stand shoulders above the rest?
Well, I guess it all the time. I'm always thinking, wow, am I really here? I mean, I don't know that I'm ever going to get over the fact that I actually did become a musician. And I am singing, you know, like if I suppose the first time I went to Russia, I was invited by a pianist over there. And I've done it four times since then. But that first tour, he said to me, Tessa, you know, you can't come out on stage, you know, a huge audience like, you know, Philharmonic Hall and be, you know, sort of like bent down, sort of slightly waving and sort of, you know, meek and sort of humble, oh, hi, I'm just Tessa from Cornwall kind of thing. You've got to come out there and, you know, people want you to be like
perform
a star. And that was very interesting to realise that your job, really, part of your job is to be what the audience wants you to be. So you're still you, but that you have to do this other part of you that you're like, wow. So I guess that was, I mean, as a first-time experience, it is very exciting to perform for a large audience and get a standing ovation. That is thrilling. But I've had, you know, a few since now, so I'm sort of more used to it. But definitely that was... That first time, I think, was like, really? I mean, I just didn't even believe it. It just seemed ridiculous.
It's an interesting observation, really, you know, and actually recognising that there's got to be a performance behind the talent that you're obviously bringing to the stage. And sometimes when I go to gigs here in Australia, with young musicians especially, sometimes I get the feeling that they haven't come to that realisation yet, that there is actually a yearning from the audience to get a little bit more than just your talent. And yeah, it's interesting you should say that. Let's talk about the new album that will be coming out.
Yeah.
And that's called Picture in Black and White. And it's inspired by the experience of discovering at the age of 28 that your father was a black Trinidadian rather than the white Spaniard.
Yes.
Which you'd been previously believed.
Yes.
So that's an interesting experience in itself, but tell us how that experience actually informed the album and the music on it.
Well, when you hear something like that, you don't kind of wake up the next day and your new identity. You really have to grow into it. And living in America as well, I kind of really felt much more strongly the kind of slave heritage, because it happened in the Caribbean. My father was from Caribbean, so, and I lived in England, so although it was part of our heritage, it's not in your face like it is in America. And I remember when I first moved to America, walking down the street one day and thinking, what, my father would have been a slave, you know, or I would have been a slave. And it was just kind of shocking. But anyway, again, very tiny. It's almost as if a teeny little pinprick of a hole was made in me that it gradually seeped into all these years. And then about 3 years ago, I started to hear certain songs through that sort of prism of the idea of the African American or Caribbean experience. And so, for example, Ornette Coleman's Lonely Woman, with the lyric by Margot Gurion, who's white. And I think Ornette Coleman wrote the song about a painting of a wealthy, rich woman. He felt she looked lonely. But somehow the two together, when I listen to that song, it seems it can't be about anything except two people who are separated by some slave owner, sending one off, you know, to the Caribbean or sending one down south or whatever they were doing. Because she's still in love with him and he's in love with her. So that's one. A Taste of Honey. To me, that seemed like, because it's in three, it sounds like a boat, and it made me think about people being shipped over from Africa and the people that got left behind and the woman who dies at the end, dreaming of his kiss. a taste more bitter than wine. That made sense to me as the people that got left behind who would come home sometimes and their children would be missing or their husband would be missing. And I wondered, you know, I can feel those experiences through these songs. So that's what a lot of it's about. But it's a little bit that I've also got like a folk song in there, Renardine, because that's kind of my heritage too, my other part of my heritage. And then there's a kind of, I wrote lyrics to Wayne Shorter's Anna Maria for my imaginary Spanish grandmother, because it's got a very flamenco kind of feeling to it. And so it's all, you know, everything you're told, you are. So even though it turns out my mother had told me that not only was my father Spanish, but that my grandmother was a flamenco dancer. And so I grew up believing that from the age of 12 until I was 28. And that, I never really got rid of that. I cannot lose that grandmother somehow.
Yeah, well, you can't sort of identify
exactly.
yourself.
Exactly. It's like, I feel like a replicant, you know, I've had all these memories implanted in me.
Yeah.
So, you know, like in Blade Runner. They're not really real, but they are.
You've arrived in Sydney in what has become quite a bad week in terms of the closure of the city's iconic live music venue.
I know.
Which you would have heard about, The Basement, due to high rental costs. Is that issue similarly evident to you in New York City in terms of high rental costs? And how do venues survive in New York City, do you think?
I think we have a lot of venues still, but tons of venues closed down. I actually used to book one called Sweet Rhythm, which was previously Sweet Basil. I just booked a vocal series there for about 3 years. That club eventually closed down, and it's now a clothing store, which is just some sort of horrendous travesty. And some of the really iconic places just died. But there are other places springing up all the time. Like last night, we went to the Foundry, which was fantastic. It was packed. It was really fun. I mean, it does look a bit officey on the outside, but inside, it's like it is a real jazz club.
That's right.
And it was real jazz playing. So you've still got, I suppose, you just have to focus on what you have. But in New York, three of my favorite clubs are this place called the 55 Bar in the Village, Mesro, also in the Village. And Smalls, all very close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But they are always packed. And it shows that there really is a thriving interest in music. But I think a lot of people think, you know, nobody's interested in jazz, it's not going to fly. But actually, it really does, if it's intelligently presented.
Yes.
And I think, like, Smalls and Mesro are owned by the same people. And if you get a ticket to Smalls, you can pop over to Mesro for free on that same ticket.
Right.
And I think also if clubs are all in the same kind of general vicinity, that's very helpful because they all feed each other. Then you might go to, it's also near the Village Vanguard.
Vanguard, that's
so
right.
you might go to see someone at the Vanguard, not be able to get in, but that's not such a big deal because you can just walk down the road and see who's at Smalls or Mesro or 55 or...
Yeah.
And if you really want to schlep over, you can go to the Blue Note. Yeah, I think the more you have, the better it is. But it has to be intelligently run, I think. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. But of course, what can you do with 40,000 a month rent? I don't know that you can really surmount an issue like
that's
that.
That's right. It certainly is a challenge.
You've got to be really intelligent to get over that.
Well, Tessa, it's been an absolute pleasure having you live here in the studio here at Northside. We're going to take a track from your album, in fact, the title track, Beyond the Blue. But this one is sort of adapted from Chopin's Prelude in E Minor. Tell us a little bit about this, and in particular, your musical collaboration with Steve Kuhn.
I was listening to a Steve Kuhn album on the Venus label, which I also had an album. I've got two albums on there, but at that time I had one. I was listening to a compilation disc, and my boyfriend is actually Billy Drummond, the drummer with the Steve Kuhn Trio. And he makes these little compilations, and accidentally one of these tracks with him on it, because he never listens to himself, was on it. And it was this beautiful version of Chopin's Prelude in E minor. And I was like, wow, what is, you know, I recognize it, but I didn't recognize it because it was very jazzy, and but just so evocative with David Fink, Billy Drummond and Steve Kuhn. And I was ordering another album from Mr. Hara, who's the producer and the owner of the Venus label. And I happened to mention that I'd been listening to it and how much I loved it. And I can't remember if I said, I don't think I said I was actually writing a lyric to it, but I had started to write a lyric to that version. And he wrote back and said, you've just given me the idea for your next album. Why don't you do an album with Steve Kuhn, with the Steve Kuhn Trio, of classical repertoire with your lyrics? And I was like, yes, why don't I? So I was like, a great idea. Yeah, please. So he, you know, that's the wonderful thing about talking of Japanese. I mean, they pay for everything and they pay you. I ended up doing that. And then Mr. Hara added some extra musicians. He said, well, why don't you have Joe Locke? Why don't you have Joel Fromm and Gary Vassese? And I said, okay, yes, thank you. Sounds good to me. And we went into the studio, and it was a very interesting way to record because I had been writing these songs. I had to research, I had to find things. It was really hard. I'm not a big classical buff. And so I was going on YouTube and then going down the rabbit warren of YouTube, finding different songs that I could feel because I had to be able to write lyrics that I could mean. Mm. And so that was kind of quite challenging. I went into the studio. We were kind of last minute. We didn't really have time to rehearse. And so we did everything. I did go over some of the songs with Steve, maybe about three, maybe four, I'm not sure. This was one of them. But the rest of it, it was all magicked up in the studio by these phenomenal, I mean, I can't even tell you how incredible, you know how incredible they all are. Mm. And so they made it into jazz. It was just like a piece of magic. We were very lucky that we were in the studio for two 10-hour days. You wouldn't normally take that long. You just go in and do like maximum 6 hours. We did it because he allowed it. And he, Mr. Hara, loved the album. He said it was his favorite. So, and I actually really, I really love this album. When I listen to it, I just love listening to the musicians, the solos, and because they had so much space, because usually you might be a bit more curtail-y, but not on this occasion because it was really a musician's kind of work. So I felt like one of the guys in a way in that.
Thanks very much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.